Let's begin with my own sponsor, Ebby. When Ebby heard how serious my drinking was, he resolved to visit me. He was in New York. I was in Brooklyn. His resolve was not enough. He had to take action and spend money. He called me on the phone and then got into the subway. Total cost, 10 cents. At the level of the telephone booth and subway turnstile, spirituality and money began to mix. One without the other would have amounted to nothing at all. Right then and there, Ebby established the principle that AA in action calls for the sacrifice of much time and a little money. Now, let us have a look at one of those little meetings we held during that first summer in Akron. We gathered in Dr. Bob's living room. Anne made her home ready for us, so we had shelter over our heads. There was some expense for coffee, and Dr. Bob paid it. If Anne and Dr. Bob had not given these hospitable services, no meeting could have been held. As the Akron meeting got larger, it moved over to the house of T. Henry and Clarice Williams. They purchased a lot of extra chairs, served many suppers, and stood for much wear and tear on their house, too. We alcoholics did not pay a cent. T. Henry and Clarice sacrificed a great amount of time and some money. If they had not done so, there could not have been any meeting. In these obvious examples, I think we can see what the test of an AA service really is. Whether it is a book, a translation, a service conference, or a 20th anniversary convention, the principle is the same. The test is identical. Do we need this particular service, or do we not? That is the only question. As AA grew, homes were no longer big enough for meetings. We had to move into hotel parlors and halls. This marked a time when the groups themselves had to begin to pay. Landlords wanted their money, so a collection had to be taken. These collections were voluntary, but great cries went up nevertheless. AA was not supposed to cost anything, it was said. We cannot mix this great spiritual idea with landlords' commercialism. But the landlords were not impressed. We had to pay or get out. So we did pay, and voluntary contributions became a fact of AA life. We could not function without them. Moreover, somebody had to collect the money and bank it and account for it. This meant the existence of a treasurer. The group soon found, too, that it needed a secretary and sometimes a chairman. Absolutely necessary arrangements had to be made, and people had to be appointed or elected to do the jobs. This often brought friction and power driving, but it was found that the group had to survive and function no matter what the cost. Means had to be found to keep friction makers and power drivers down to their right size. A suitable service committee, considerable mild coercion, coupled with much love and understanding, proved to be the answer. So these sometimes frightening experiences were not bad for us, after all. They helped everybody to grow. Meanwhile, the group went on functioning because it had to function or fail in its mission. Cities and areas had their own special service problems. Unable to reach AA on the phone, alcoholics and their families got discouraged as they tried to contact us. This caused needless suffering and sometimes loss of life. Hospitals also became tired of slapdash, irresponsible admittance of patients into their institutions. This condition was not simplicity at all. It was complication. Sponsorship into these places and out of them became imperative. Otherwise, the hospitals might get fed up and quit. Ignoring the cries of, "Let us keep it simple," and goaded by the sheer necessity of the situation, responsible old-timers in such areas would often hire a small office and a paid secretary and would then act as a management committee for the service center. Next, the old-timers would ask the surrounding groups for voluntary contributions. When these failed to meet the needs of the simple and inexpensive setup, they often went into their own pockets. If the newly hired secretary happened to be an AA member, this was a surefire cause for trouble. The often frightened little gal soon learned that she was considered a professional AA, making money out of it. Of course, this was unfounded, because primarily she was doing a secretarial job. Over the years, the areas learned the same lessons the groups did. They found what was necessary to make an AA area function and what was not. Out of this long travail and struggle, AA's present intergroup or area central offices have emerged. In scores of cities, they are doing a vitally necessary job. Meanwhile, we found that we needed services that we could not perform ourselves. Chief among these was the right kind of hospitalization. Doctoring and physically caring for the very sick was not and could not be AA's business. Here, great friends like Dr. Silkworth and Sister Ignatia came to our aid. An ever-growing number of hospitals has since welcomed us into the closest cooperation. Among these pioneers was Charles B. Towns Hospital in New York, St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, St. Vincent Charity Hospital in Cleveland, and Knickerbocker Hospital in New York. These and many others are superb examples of what our friends outside of AA have done to help us better to function and to serve. In addition to these hospitals, we find today an impressive list of drying out places. Farms, state and provincial clinics, and many kinds of civic and professional people and groups all interested in the solution of the problem of alcoholism. Jurists, penologists, educational committees, psychiatrists, great industrial enterprises, all are helping. What these outside services have meant in terms of aid to AA and endorsement of our society is beyond estimate. The world of religion likewise has come to our aid. We enjoy the blessings of practically all sects and denominations. Any number of us, as individuals, have been counseled and brought into greater spiritual understanding and growth by the help of devoted clergymen. Without all this outside help, AA might never have started in the first place or grown so well since. These were and still are indispensable services. Another great service has been performed by AA's friends of press, radio, and all kinds of communications. These agencies have given AA millions of dollars of free publicity. They have brought alcoholics to us by the tens of thousands, and they never have required anything of us except our cooperation in getting the story of AA before the world. We know that without the help of these friends, our growth would have been slow indeed. Now we come to the story of AA's world services. Because these activities are so remote from most of us, not many know how AA's overall service structure was built or what it has accomplished. To those who do know the real story, this is one of the most vital and exciting developments in all our history. When Dr. Bob and I realized on that fall day in 1937 that some 20 of us had recovered from alcoholism, we at once asked ourselves, how can this experience be shared? How can the word be spread? Dr. Bob had recovered 2.5 years before, and I had been sober 3 years. It had taken all this time to perfect the recovery program and to bring sobriety to a handful of sufferers. The number of alcoholics in the world who wanted to get well was reckoned in millions. How could the great chance we had had be brought to them? At the snail's pace we had been going, it was clear that most of them could never be reached. We could, therefore, no longer be a seldom heard of secret society. Word of mouth communication with the few alcoholics we could contact by our then current methods would be not only slow, but dangerous. Dangerous because the recovery message in which we now had such high confidence might soon be garbled and twisted beyond recognition. Clearly, our budding society and its message would have to be publicized. Hardly a fraction of the world's alcoholics could be expected to come to Akron or New York for treatment. Somehow, we would have to reach them where they were. Maybe we would have to get some of our members subsidized as missionaries to do this. It was already plain that most hospitals did not want to be bothered with alcoholics. Their beds were filled with people who seemed better subjects for treatment. Perhaps we would need to operate a chain of hospitals, and maybe the proceeds of such a venture would pay the missionaries. Above all, we would have to put our methods down on paper. A book of experience could carry our message to distant places we could never visit ourselves. Moreover, Such a book could prevent the otherwise inevitable garble and distortion that would start as soon as publicity came. It would not only guide alcoholics to recovery, but also become the basis for telling our story to the world, and therefore a guide to our public relations as well. These were our reflections and speculations. Dr. Bob very much liked the idea of a book, but when it came to paid missionaries and profit-making hospitals, he was frankly dubious. Promoter that I was, I shared few of his fears. I felt that we would have to have money, and maybe a lot of it. Neither of us could give the work our full attention unless we were subsidized, and our members could not be expected to throw over their jobs and ignore their families' needs in order to do free missionary work. If we had our own hospitals, we would have to be financed. The book alone would take considerable time and some money. Neither Dr. Bob nor I had money. We had only debts. Every other member was in much the same fix. We would simply have to solicit money or get nowhere. Only half convinced, Dr. Bob rightly wondered what all these complications might do to the spirit of our undertaking, the carrying of our message to fellow alcoholics with no strings and no money attached. Finally, he said, "Why don't we call the Akron boys together and have a meeting at T. Henry's? Let's try these ideas out on them." At T. Henry's house, 18 of the Akron alcoholics listened stolidly to our proposals. I kept pouring on my arguments for missionaries, hospitals, and the book as thick as I could. Despite his doubts, Dr. Bob strongly backed me up, especially about the need for a book. The moment we were through, those alcoholics really did work us over. They rejected the idea of missionaries. Paid workers, they said, would kill our goodwill with alcoholics. This would be sheer ruin. If we went into the hospital business, everybody would say it was a racket. Many thought we must shun publicity. We would be swamped. We could not handle the traffic. Some turned thumbs down on pamphlets and books. After all, they said, the apostles themselves did not need any printed matter. Dr. Bob and I returned to the fray and renewed our pressure. But this settled nothing, and a vote had to be taken. By the barest majority and over the most strenuous objections, the Akron meeting finally decided that we ought to go for the whole works, the missionaries, the hospitals, and the book. Even then, no one present volunteered to do much about these things. If a lot of money was needed, I had better go back to New York, where there was plenty, and raise it myself. Such was the verdict of that meeting, and a mighty close shave it was. In later years, I came to be very thankful for that powerful minority. Their contention that going into big business and hiring paid missionaries would destroy us turned out to be absolutely correct. On the other hand, had the ultra-conservatives prevailed, and had we done nothing, AA might have got nowhere after all. Though I did not see it then, the group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous was already at work, hammering out right decisions for AA's future. The majority of the meeting had given me permission to do as I wanted, and it was quite easy for the time being to ignore the minority warnings. But that was not the end of the minority, as we shall presently see. Much elated, I grabbed a train for home. I figured that the new developments would take millions of dollars. Our little New York group gave me more encouragement than had the Akronites. Most of them soon fell in with my grandiose notions. It was felt that raising money for such a noble enterprise should present no difficulties at all. We said to each other, "Why, this is probably one of the greatest medical and spiritual developments of all time. Certainly the rich will help us. How could they do anything else?" Then, too, the New York group had already scraped up a couple of super salesmen, people who thought exactly as I did. So AA's first and last great crusade for money got off to a flying start. Armed with a list of wealthy prospects, we commenced to solicit funds. To our astonishment, we got absolutely nowhere. Some of the wealthy exhibited mild concern and sympathy, but they were not really interested. Almost unanimously, they seemed to think that tuberculosis, cancer, and the Red Cross were better charity investments. Why should they try to revive a lot of down-and-out alcoholics who had brought their troubles upon themselves. In great dejection, we finally saw that drunks, as objects of large charity, might never be a popular cause. I was quite angry and depressed, and in this mood I visited the office of my brother-in-law, Dr. Leonard B. Strong, Jr., to whom I delivered a diatribe on the stinginess and short-sightedness of the rich. Ours was a movement that would doubtless sweep the world. What was the matter with people anyway? Leonard had heard all this before, and somewhat wearily he said, "Years ago, I knew a man called Willard Richardson. As I remember, he had something to do with John D. Rockefeller's charities. I think he used to be very close to the Rockefeller family. If he is still alive, I believe he would remember me. Maybe he is still at the Rockefeller offices. I'll call up and find out." Leonard called, and at once the voice of one of our greatest friends-to-be, Mr. Willard Richardson, came over the wire. He said, "Why, hello, Leonard. Where have you been all these years? I'd love to see you." My brother-in-law replied, "I have with me a relative who has had some success in straightening out alcoholics. Could we come and talk to you about it?" Mr. Richardson said, "Of course you can. How about tomorrow?" The next morning, Leonard and I alighted on the 56th floor of the RCA building where Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. had his offices. Soon we were shaking hands with Mr. Richardson, an elderly gentleman who had twinkling eyes set in one of the finest faces I have ever seen. He was warmly cordial. He showed the deepest interest as I unfolded the story of our struggling fellowship. After he had heard me out, that wonderful gentleman said, "I think we should have another meeting soon. Maybe you and I ought to have lunch together. What about next week?" In the elevator lobby, my brother-in-law ran into a commuter friend who said, "So you have been in to see Mr. Richardson. If you happen to want anything from Mr. Rockefeller personally, he is certainly your man. He has been in charge of Mr. Rockefeller's private charities for years." This was terrific. Here was the inside track. Here was a patron at last. Our money troubles were over. As promoters, we were doing all right after all. At lunch with Mr. Richardson the following week, my expectations were confirmed. He was keenly interested in the story of our society and its needs. He proposed still another meeting to be held in Mr. Rockefeller's private boardroom. He would bring with him Mr. Albert Scott, chairman of the trustees for Riverside Church, Mr. Frank Amos, an advertising man and close friend, and Mr. A. Leroy Chipman, an associate who looked after some of Mr. Rockefeller's personal affairs. And, of course, there would be Dr. Strong, who had brought us together. I was to bring Dr. Silkworth and some of the New York alcoholics, along with Dr. Bob and certain members from Akron. I rushed home to Brooklyn and excitedly called Dr. Bob. We were riding high on Pink Cloud number 17. The historic evening in December 1937 finally arrived. We had supper and presently found ourselves in Mr. Rockefeller Jr.'s private boardroom. My chair at the great table felt warm, and it was explained that Mr. Rockefeller himself had just vacated it. This made the chair feel even warmer. We were certainly getting close now. There was a rather awkward pause while our friends waited for us to say something. I guess we were a bit awestruck. Then someone suggested that each alcoholic present tell his own story, just as he would at a meeting. As we told our several tales of alcoholic misery and release, we could see that a very deep impression was being made. When we were through, Mr. Scott, who chaired the meeting at the head of the table, exclaimed, "Why, this is first century Christianity." And then, still more to the point, he added, "What can we do to help?" Our big moment had come. I mentioned our need for money, for paid workers, chains of hospitals, and literature. Though we could, of course, start modestly, these things eventually might require large sums. The need, I ventured, was very urgent. Though the risks of such undertakings might be considerable, the risk of doing nothing whatever would certainly be greater. Dr. Silkworth and the rest of our contingent at the table expressed the same opinion. Then Mr. Scott posed a question that is still heard in AA to this day. "Won't money spoil this thing?" he asked. The discussion became general, and we were bombarded with questions. Won't money create a professional class? Wouldn't professional members spoil the man-to-man approach that is now successful? Wouldn't the management of a hospital chain with all the property and money required be a fatal diversion? This barrage of questions was disconcerting. Though they were calm about it, these men sounded for all the world like the vociferous minority out there in Akron. We all realized that, coming from such unbiased friends, these were good questions indeed. We answered that we had already pondered these perils ourselves, but had finally concluded that to do nothing at all would be even more perilous. Being deeply convinced that this was true, we earnestly continued to press our case with the same arguments that had been used in Akron. At last, impressed with this logic, our new friends began to yield. They admitted that we did need money, at least some money. At this point, Mr. Amos, who was to become a great friend and a longtime trustee for AA, promised to make an investigation of our society, which might be the basis for asking Mr. Rockefeller for some funds. Mr. Amos had never laid eyes on us before, and we were deeply moved by this evidence of his interest and generosity. We suggested that Mr. Amos first look at the Akron group. Akron was our first group and our largest. It worked in a more typical community than New York. If an AA hospital were to be put into operation, the Akron location would be better, and Dr. Bob would be available to superintend it. For fear of embarrassing Dr. Bob, there was another reason we did not mention. Though more than 2 years sober, he had been unable to revive his surgical practice. People were glad for his sobriety, but they still feared the knife in his hands. Each was asking, "What if he gets drunk the morning he cuts me up?" We knew Dr. Bob was facing a mortgage foreclosure on his home, and if any money was forthcoming, he needed it more than any of the rest of us. A week later, Frank Amos arrived in Akron and ran a fine-tooth comb through the situation there. He questioned local citizens and certain medical associates of Dr. Bob's. He went to several meetings and talked with each alcoholic member. He also looked at a large vacant residence, which might be converted into a hospital where Dr. Bob could work. Frank caught the contagion, and he came back to New York red hot. At the conclusion of his enthusiastic report, he recommended that Mr. Rockefeller grant us $50,000 just as a starter. With this money, two or three of us could be subsidized, a down payment on the hospital could be made, and Dr. Bob could be relieved of his mortgage troubles. Mr. Richardson quickly took the glowing report to his friend Mr. Rockefeller, who we thought would surely be interested. Here was medicine, here was religion, and here was a great good work, all in one package. Dick Richardson read Frank's report and then added his own account of what he had seen and heard from us. Mr. Rockefeller listened intently. He was tremendously impressed and said so. He has continued to say so ever since and has repeatedly stated that his connection with Alcoholics Anonymous is numbered among the finest and most moving experiences of his life. Nevertheless, Mr. Rockefeller flatly turned down this plea for a large sum, despite the fact that our project appealed to his every charitable inclination. After a rereading of Frank's report, he said to his old friend, "Dick, I am afraid that money will spoil this thing." When he gave his reasons, they were identical with those advanced by the Akron group's minority. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. was guided then and there to save the AA Fellowship from itself and from unnecessary hazards of money, property, and professionalism. It was one of the turning points in AA's history. His great wealth could have ruined us. At this juncture, Dick Richardson described the desperate financial plight of Dr. Bob and myself. On hearing of this, Mr. Rockefeller said, "I will place $5,000 for their use in the treasury of the Riverside Church. You may draw on this as you like. This will give these men some temporary assistance. But this fellowship should soon become self-supporting. If you and the others do not happen to agree, if you really think that the movement needs money, of course you can help them to raise it. But please don't ever ask me for any more." This was very great news for Alcoholics Anonymous, but at the time, it seemed like bad news. It was, in fact, a shattering blow to our hopes. Nevertheless, Dr. Bob and I were grateful to get off the hook, even for a little while. The small mortgage on Dr. Bob's place was paid off, and each of us began to receive $30 a week for as long as the money might last. Otherwise, we stood just where we had been all along. The prospect of missionaries and hospitals and the book had gone dim. Uncle Dick Richardson was definitely disappointed, and so were friends Amos, Chipman, and Strong. Seeing that they were not in complete agreement with Mr. Rockefeller, we renewed our pleas for aid. Maybe they would know of other men of wealth who might be solicited with more success. To our delight, all four thought this possible, and we held frequent meetings to talk about it. By the spring of 1938, a definite program of action took shape. It was agreed that we needed a tax-free charitable trust or foundation. Wealthy contributors could then deduct gifts from their tax returns. Such a foundation would be a responsible repository for these funds and would guarantee the wise use of all contributions. Messrs. Richardson, Amos, and Chipman agreed to serve as trustees, and so did my brother-in-law, Dr. Strong. These were the first steps in forming the Alcoholic Foundation, recently renamed the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Frank Amos next secured the valuable help of a young friend, John Wood, then a rising junior in one of New York's famous law offices. This gave us the best possible legal talent. John Wood sat in at our meetings, and we commenced our work. The first move was to choose a name for the new outfit. After long discussion, we decided to call it the Alcoholic Foundation. This seemed like a resounding title, one that could create an impression of large importance. Still swayed by big ideas, we thought our trusteeship ought to be chartered to do just about anything within the field of alcohol or alcoholism, except lobby for prohibition. We intended an arrangement by which we could research, educate, and do a lot of other things. Attention to our membership would be only one of many functions. Thus, the Alcoholic Foundation got its name and its charter. Then we ran up against a legal riddle. It was thought that the Board of Trustees should consist of alcoholics and non-alcoholics. The latter were always to be in the majority by a margin of one. This would assure our membership and other contributors that non-alcoholics would be holding the purse strings. Mr. Wood then blandly asked us to define an alcoholic and then a non-alcoholic. We came up with a definition that the alcoholic was a sick person who couldn't drink at all. The non-alcoholic, we surmised, was a perfectly well man who could drink if he wanted to. This made no legal sense at all, and Mr. Wood, still puzzled, finally gave up the attempt to describe an alcoholic in legal terms. But he soon found a way out of the impasse by suggesting that we write up a simple trust agreement and sign it. This would avoid the whole business of a formalized charter. Soon afterward, this document was completed, and the Alcoholic Foundation was in business. Our first board consisted of five trustees. Dick Richardson, Frank Amos, and Dr. Strong were the non-alcoholic members, and we chose Dr. Bob and one of the New York AAs as the alcoholic contingent. The New York member soon got drunk, but this possibility had been foreseen. Drunkenness on the part of an alcoholic trustee meant immediate resignation. Another alcoholic was named in the drunken brother's place, and we proceeded to business. It was May 1938. Our friends came up with a promised list of wealthy men who might be solicited, and from early summer to early fall, we pounded that list of prospects. With a tax-free foundation and the kind of friends we now had, we thought our money problems would be a pushover. But the attraction of tax exemptions and responsible trustees seemed to make no difference. For a while, Carlton Sherwood, a friend of Dick Richardson's, lent us a hand. Mr. Sherwood was a very successful money raiser for charities, but he found he could do little for us because we were too uncertain and glum ourselves. So the whole business bogged down, and the treasury of our foundation remained empty. It looked like the end of the line. Sometime in March or April of 1938, I began to work on what was to become the book Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time our big money push was underway, I had completed my own story and had roughed out what is now the second chapter of the AA book. Mimeograph copies of these two chapters were part of the paraphernalia for the money-raising operation, which had now fizzled out. Anxious to encourage us, our friends insisted on monthly trustee meetings. For a while, nothing happened at them, except commiseration for the fact of the Foundation's empty treasury. But at one of these meetings in the early fall of 1938, Frank Amos popped up with an idea which opened the door upon our real future. Frank said, "One of my friends, Eugene Exman, is religious editor of Harper. Perhaps he would be interested in your new book. Why don't you go down there and show him the few chapters you have done? I'll fix it up for you." So down I went to meet Gene Exman, another wonderful friend to be of our society. I related the tale of our struggles and handed over to him my first attempt at authorship. While I waited, Gene thoughtfully scanned the two chapters. Then he asked, "Could you do a whole book in this style? And how many months would it take you?" I was shaking, but I had an answer ready. "I believe I can do it. It will probably take 9 or 10 months." Thereupon, he made a proposal that was surprising. "If it would help things along," he said, "I think Harper might be willing to advance you $1,500 in royalties. This amount would be deducted from your account when the book is finished in 1939. Again in the clouds, I left Harper to break the great news to the gang. I first headed for a visit with Frank Amos, but on the way there, my elation was disturbed by disquieting thoughts. Suppose our embryo book were someday to become the chief text for our fellowship. Our principal written asset would then be owned by an outside publisher, a fine and conservative one, surely, but nevertheless an outsider. So I wondered if our fellowship should own its own book. Then I thought about the $1,500 of advance royalties. When the book was done, I would still owe Harper that sum, and a good many volumes would have to be sold just to get even. And suppose that when the book appeared, there were to be heavy publicity, and thousands of cries for help from alcoholics and their families began to pour in. We would not have any money to cope with this quite possible situation. I kept these misgivings to myself, and it was good to see Frank's face light up as he heard the news. In any case, it was fine to know that a firm like Harper wanted the book, and that an editor of Gene's caliber believed that it was going to be good. This experience was one of the competence builders that kept the book project going through thick and thin. At the next Foundation meeting, our friends smiled happily as they heard the details of the Harper project. It was the first ray of hope we had seen in months. The trustees were unanimous in their opinion that the Harper deal was the answer. I had shared my doubts with a few New York friends about the Harper proposal, but thinking about them elsewhere. Now, very reluctantly, I told the trustees what they were. But our non-alcoholics on the board were not impressed with my reasons. They pointed to the well-known fact that authors seldom publish their own books and get away with it. The meeting ended on a dismal note. We were a hung jury. No conclusion or verdict was reached. Soon afterward, one of the most terrific power drivers I have ever met got into the act. This was my friend Henry P., one-time Standard Oil executive and the very first alcoholic ever to stay sober even a little while in the New York group. He had been a protege of Dr. Silkworth's and a frequent visitor at Towns Hospital. At this time, he had been sober about 2 years. Henry had red hair, at least one new idea a minute, and energy beyond telling. He was not a Foundation trustee, and he had no official say at all, but that mattered not a bit. He was a hard-hitting salesman, and he sold his bill of goods. He said, "Look here, Bill, why do we bother any more with those trustees in that Foundation? Those folks have not raised a cent, and they're not going to. Why don't we put this proposed book on a business basis and form a stock company? Let's sell shares to our own folks right here in New York. If we give them a real argument, I'll guarantee they will get up the dough." I was an ex-Wall Streeter and had already toyed with this notion myself, But Henry had much bigger ideas, and he breathed confidence. Our society would organize its own publishing company, and maybe we would have to forget about the foundation. I told him the trustees would never agree to our scheme, and I did not want to hurt their feelings. But Henry's skin was thicker than mine. He was implacable. He said that it simply had to be done, and I finally agreed. Still much disturbed about the whole business, I went back to Gene X-Men and frankly explained to him what was about to happen. To my utter amazement, he agreed, quite contrary to his own interest, that a society like ours ought to control and publish its own literature. Moreover, he felt that very possibly we could do this with success. Though Gene's opinion did not register at all when it was transmitted to the trustees, it did give Henry and me the kind of encouragement we so much needed. Henry wasted no time, but started selling the proposition to our New York members at once. He buttonholed them one by one, persuading, browbeating, hypnotizing. I trailed around in his wake, smoothing ruffled feelings and trying to dispel some of the suspicions that had been created about our motives. After a couple of weeks of this kind of violent promotion, we got a lukewarm consent from our Eastern membership. Dr. Bob was dubious, but he also consented. He did think it would be unwise at this stage to lay the matter before the Akron membership. Some promotion might be justifiable in New York, but few Akronites would be able to see it, he thought. He felt, too, that we should try the idea out on the Board of Trustees. We surely could not ignore them. Meanwhile, Henry and I were perfecting our plan. It would take a persuasive prospectus to include alcoholics to part with their money for stock in a company that had not yet produced even one book. But the more we investigated, the better the proposition looked. We went to Edward Blackwell, the president of Cornwall Press, one of the largest printers in the United States. Here we discovered that the printing cost of an average-sized book is only about 10% of its retail price. A 400-page volume could be printed for only a fraction of a dollar. If we were to price our new book at $3.50, as Henry and I figured it, this would be practically all net profit. There would be no bookstore commission, no paid advertising, and none of the usual losses that publishers had to take on books that did not sell. Our book, of course, would sell, and we could not fail to clean up. It looked too good to be true. I laid this information before the next trustees meeting. I anticipated that the reaction would be bad, and it certainly was. To flatly disagree with these wonderful friends was the toughest possible assignment. Once more, the trustees meeting adjourned without agreement. I knew we would have to go through with the deal despite all the objections. It was depressing. But Henry was not depressed. He had been sitting up nights working on a prospectus. The main arguments were these. Harper had said the book was going to be a good one, and even if we paid our groups and outside bookstores a dollar a book for distribution, there would still be a whopping profit margin. The book could be printed at very low cost and sold for $2.50 wholesale or $3.50 by mail order. And when the reviews and other publicity got rolling, we were certain there would be sales by the carload. The prospectus suggested that a company be formed with stock of $25 par value. The New York Alcoholics and their friends could buy one-third of these shares for cash. The other two-thirds would be distributed between Henry and me for our work. To mollify the trustees, it was decided that the author's royalty, which would ordinarily be mine, could go to the Alcoholic Foundation. To the prospectus, Henry attached a chart which showed the estimated profits on sales of 100,000, 500,000, and even 1 million books. I have now forgotten just what his hopes were, but they were fantastic. I was not quite so optimistic, but I did feel sure that the proceeds of the book would enable several of us to become full-time workers and to set up a general headquarters for our society. Whether this worked out or not, I was nevertheless convinced that our fellowship ought to own and control its own literature. Our enterprise still lacked two essentials. It was not incorporated, and it did not have a name. Henry took care of these matters, Since the forthcoming volume would be only the first of many such works, he thought our publishing company should be called Works Publishing Incorporated. This was all right with me, but I protested that we had no incorporation on which to base shares, and that incorporation would take money. Next day, I found that Henry had bought a pad of blank stock certificates in a stationery store, and across the top of each certificate was typed this legend, Works Publishing Incorporated, par value $25. At the bottom, there was a signature, Henry P., President. When I protested these irregularities, Henry said there was no time to waste. Why be concerned with small details? So the great enterprise was launched. It remained to be seen if it would float. Henry knew every stratagem of the super salesman, and he got right down to work. He descended like a whirlwind on the New York alcoholics and some of their friends, suggesting that they take stock in the glittering new venture. I was no second rater at this sort of thing myself, and I followed right along. Well, we did not sell even one of our proposed 600 shares of Works Publishing, cheap as we claimed it was. The New York alcoholic said, "You fellows have certainly got nerve. What made you think that we would buy stock in a book not yet written?" But Henry was not discouraged. He still had ideas. "Bill," he said, "you and I know this book is going to sell, and Harper thinks it will sell. But these New York drunks just do not believe it. Some take it as a joke, and the rest talk high and holy about mixing a spiritual enterprise with money and promotion. But if they really did think that the book would sell, they would buy the stock all right and fast. So why don't we go up and see the Reader's Digest people and find out if they'll print a piece about our fellowship in this book. If the Digest runs an article about us, we will sell those books by the carloads. Anybody can see that, even these tightwad drunks. So what are we waiting for? Let's go." 2 days later, at Pleasantville, New York, in the office of Mr. Kenneth Payne, then managing editor of the Digest, we drew a glowing picture of our fellowship and its book to be. We mentioned the high interest of Mr. Rockefeller and some of his friends. Mr. Payne was interested. After a while, he said, "I am almost sure the Digest would like to handle this story, though, of course, I'll have to check it up with the other editors. Personally, I think it is just the sort of thing we are looking for. When your book is ready next spring, let me know, and I think we can put a feature writer to work. This should be a great story, but of course, I must check it up with the staff first. That's understood, isn't it?" Henry and I reached for our hats and sped for New York. Now we had real ammunition. That very night, we started a fresh canvas, and the former doubters began to sign up. Nearly everybody was broke at the time, so we made things easy for them. They could buy their shares on the installment plan, $5 a month for 5 months for each share. Many could afford only a single share. When the trustees were brought up to date, they loyally pitched in, too. Some AAs had friends who signed up for small amounts. Certain of my old Wall Street cronies tossed in a few chips. People like Dr. Silkworth and Dr. Tebow lent a hand. Soon we had a subscription of 200 shares, which amounted to $5,000, and a little actual money began to come in. However, the subscribers were not animated wholly by commercialism. After receiving just a little assurance that they might someday get their money back, they really got behind the deal. At 17 William Street, Newark, New Jersey, Henry had an office which was the headquarters for a rapidly failing business. He also had a secretary named Ruth Hawk, who was to become one of AA's real pioneers. The other assets consisted of a huge desk and some plush furniture. Each morning, I traveled all the way from Brooklyn to Newark, where, pacing up and down in Henry's office, I began to dictate rough drafts of the chapters of the coming book. As we seemed unable to come up with any genuine outline for the publication, I worked from a hastily drawn-up list of possible chapter headings. Week after week, Henry raced around among the stock subscribers, prodding them for their installments. In addition to this dribble of money, we were able to secure $2,500 from Mr. Charles B. Towns. Most of these funds had to be devoted to office expenses and groceries for Henry, Ruth, Lois, and myself, and we kept going on this basis until April 1939, the publication date of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous.